This is the last lecture I'll record for this class. It's from a text that was released a month before the class began in 2020. I must say that it's not the best example of writing from Uchelan. I included it because it was the one that I know of that focuses specifically on the question of freedom and what is that. I honestly think that the answer that he gives is not as compelling as many of the other things that he has to say. But I think that the situation in which Uchelan exists and the movement that is following from, in large measure, from his recommendations about freedom and about society and about political and social and economic structuration. I'm referring to the Kurdish project of democratic confederalism in Rojava. That, to me, along with the Zapatistas, is one of the most hopeful things in the world. I mean, it's barely existing right now. I'm recording this in November 2020. The enclaves of Kurdish self-determination have now been separated from one another and are under occupation by Russian and Turkish and Assad's Syrian troops right now. But the Kurdish Democratic Confederalist forces are significant. They have maybe 150,000 fighters. And so the last I heard a couple months back when I talked to my Kurdish friend, they're still holding those cities. But this project that they have begun, which is 10 or 15 years old, depending on how you look at it, is very similar in its political structuration to the Zapatista form of self-government. It's a form of democracy without a state, is the way that they would look at it. It involves a whole bunch of cooperative economic units, communes at the infrastructural level, and council, integrated council systems where local co-ops, schools, self-defense groups, neighborhoods all have their own circles, their assemblies, their smaller or larger assemblies where people get together, discuss the things that impact them, make decisions about them, and then an integrative confederal network by which these councils can speak with other councils without letting authority devolve into the hands of the few people who do this interconnecting, but with a formal set of mechanisms for keeping decision-making power at the grassroots level, right? Like, this really exists. It's super cool. There's a text which maybe I should have used instead, but I prefer to look at Uchelan's writing. Uchelan has some really beautiful passages. This one, like I said, I'll critique. You know, I think he's generally right about some things. I think his presentation of freedom here is a little, well, I can criticize it. But, you know, his recommendations for social, economic, and political organization are kind of beautifully written out. There's a lot of dependence on Bookchin, Emmanuel Wallerstein, Michel Foucault, Fernand Braudel, world systems theory, this sort of stuff, and a long view that we've talked about sometimes in this class where the capacities and possibilities of humans in terms of their social organization and their political possibilities are not limited to so-called civilization, but the view is much longer than that. You know, we have 5,000 years of state structures in this world, maybe only 300 years of the dominance of those systems over the majority of the Earth's population, which is pretty crazy. Halfway through European colonization is the first time when the majority of the Earth's population lived under state structures in divided societies. And only since maybe 1950 or so that almost every aspect of the globe is now dominated by a state-like formation. So one merit of Uchelan is a refusal to estimate humans on the basis of the state and capitalist institutions which now dominate the globe, but a wish to look more broadly and on a longer historical scale. And when he does this, he sees that most societies were matriarchal, not patriarchal. It's the state societies that are patriarchal. Most societies were democratic, not autocratic. It's the state and capitalist societies, which always involve top-down rule and so on. So he's got a very broad rule, but then he actually wrote up this thing that they call the social contract, which a bunch of Kurdish people who trusted him because they had been fighting with him. He was a leader within the PKK, which is a Kurdish resistance group, a Kurdish independence group. This is the reason he's in prison now, because he engaged in guerrilla warfare against the Turkish army in particular. The Turks, together with the United States, with the CIA and probably the Mossad, operated together to confine this man who's writing the text that you're reading from within a one-man prison on an island surrounded by 1,000 Turkish troops. I mean, come on, how cinematic is that? So anyway, you can find better things to write to read from him. I would recommend the text called Democratic Confederalism. And then there's another text by Knapp, K-N-A-P-P, and it's escaping me what the other author is. But it's about Rojava, and it just gives you a sort of like listing for 200 or 300 pages of the different structures according to which Kurdish society in Rojava. Rojava is a smaller territory of what would be Kurdistan, basically along the northern Syrian border. What are the patterns economically, socially, and politically, militarily that are being enacted in that place today? So I could have given you a better text, but I gave you the one about freedom. And I definitely think that there is a very important set of possibilities for freedom represented by the real practices of this man and his affiliates and the people who are now following his recommendations. There is a familiar beginning point for analysis in this text, I think, with like, you know, what we've been talking about in general, so I'll only talk it through quickly. His basic claim is that through the entire history of these state structures, you know, beginning in ancient Sumer and in China along the Yellow River, and then, you know, expanding, but not that quickly, into eventually the ancient world and so on, that all these forms, whether they're called, you know, early state forms, like, you know, the Egyptian form with like a priesthood that overlaps with the leadership, or whether we're talking about later imperial forms like ancient Rome, or to move up to the present, capitalist imperial forms, or even state socialist forms, they all are a part of what he would call modern civilization or capitalist civilization. And even the state socialist arrangements like Assad's Syria, according to Öcalan, basically have the same characteristics of capitalism. You can see the same thing in Soviet Russia, for example. They still rest upon surplus accumulation. They cause a large majority of the population, the vast majority of the population, to work under external direction so as to produce a surplus of various sorts, surplus of grain, surplus of money, which then is controlled by the external people who determined the activity in the first place, and their control over this surplus is then used as their lever, their foothold, by which to control that population. So like in Marx, the harder we work, the more we're imprisoned, right? That is true. I mean, Öcalan would say that's true whether we're talking about a capitalist society or a socialist society, at least in the state socialist sense. What he's really looking for is a better form of socialism, which he thinks has to be a stateless form of socialism. Okay, so there's a problematic set of systems which at one point only imprisoned, and all of these state systems, and here I'm really referring to like James C. Scott's book Against the Grain is an easy sort of easy read to get into this picture. All of these systems were based on slavery. They're based on unfree labor, and they concentrated this production in order to control the population, but that they also contributed to population growth. They wanted maximum population either through seizing slaves or by causing people to reproduce, you know, within the confines of their food supplies and so on, but as greatly as possible. So population growth is not separable from civilization and state growth. Nor is it separate from contemporary capitalism. Don't just blame it on the third world. Blame it on the system that produces surpluses of grain and so on. But these systems have historically been based on slavery, and they have produced surplus populations for the purpose of warfare. They have always been expansive. On this long view, it's the state form which is the real problem. Now, in our contemporary version of this, in, say, you know, modernity, in modern civilization, society is dissolved, and here we can be talking about neoliberalism even more specifically. Society is dissolved into a bunch of individuals who are separate from one another, and there's a clear point in doing this because a bunch of people who are separate from one another cannot stand up against a big machinery that is itself organized and where all the parts and all the individuals involved in the state and the capitalist apparatuses, they work as a group. So in society, in our consumer dimension, when we're at home, we experience ourselves as individuals. But this is not just a truth. It's an historical situation. And it's not a neutral historical situation, nor is it a desirable historical situation. It's a tactical situation. We have been weakened, right? We have been robbed of our power because on Öcalan's view, our power and our freedom consist fundamentally, just like Hannah Arendt, in our participating in politics and not big politics or what he'll call like the politics of power, of dominating power is what he means. Like the Republican and the Democratic machines, that's not politics. We don't like that's, you know, that's the spectacle. That's a TV show. That's a circus that they'll give you along with a little snatch of bread to keep you shut up. But you don't take part in it. That's not like really engaging your potentialities or you acting upon your situation together with people around you. That's what society would be. That's what freedom would be. So as opposed to this history of state hierarchical forms, Öcalan claims there has always been a democratic correlate. There have always been aspects of life where we depended on one another, where our relationships were really not atomized entirely down to individuality. There are practices of shared spaces, of shared goods, of shared activities. There are situations where people make agreements through discussion, where they are not related by forms of domination, but by mutually respectful recognitions, which lead to discussions, which lead to evaluations, which lead to joint action. Right, his claim is that this has existed all along, and it has to. If you look at the more contemporary analyses of, the birth and then the continuation of capitalism, say by people like Federici, they point out that social reproduction, the feeding, the nurturing, the emotional tending to, the sexual tending to, and then the actual reproduction of children, these things have taken place outside of the official economy. The capitalist world is structured so as to make use of them. So women are stuck in the home as a part of the move to factory labor. This is one of the key points of, you know, autonomous feminism. And yet that care work, which ends up supporting the system, also exists outside of the system. There's always an outside. Now there's less and less of an outside. But it's always there. That democratic possibility is there. And the question for him is like, which aspect of our world are we going to augment? You could go back to Spinoza and say, like, here are these activities, which really taken in whole are all that we are. You know, Marx says this. This is a materialist view. What am I but my activity? Which of these activities, the ones that contribute to surplus production, the accumulation of value and power of different forms in the hands of a few people outside of us, do we want to augment those activities? Certainly we are encouraged to do so. You know, you're supposed to work more and more, and even when you're not working, you should be building yourself as a brand to become, go to school, develop some skills that they want. Do you want to do that? Or do we want to look at those aspects of our life which are already egalitarian, joy-bringing, caring, loving, and so on? Do we want to choose the surplus-oriented modernity, or do we want to choose the democratic civilization instead? And of course, Öcalan prefers the latter. Okay, so now let me move on and just say the things that he says about freedom, and I'll be done for the course. Let me criticize him first. I had read over this, skimmed over it once when I put it into the class, and I knew that I wanted to put him last. And again, I kind of wish I had picked something else. But there are weaknesses in Öcalan's thought. There are weaknesses, I think, in some anarchist thought that moves along these lines. And in Öcalan, I see the weakness coming through Bookchin, who is an anarchist philosopher with whom Öcalan has been in contact. Right, part of this read of the long story is coming from Murray Bookchin. I think Murray Bookchin's recommendations are right. I think Uchulan's recommendations are right. I think their analysis of a few things are kind of, I don't know, naive or overly simplistic, or in this case, I would say problematically Hegelian. So there are some things that Uchulan is saying that I would not agree with. I'll tell you what they are. Maybe you agree with them. He thinks that all of the universe is in a process of evolution. Hegel said that. Early anarchists like Bakunin said that. To me, it's like some of the least persuasive moments of that anarchist tradition. Emma Goldman will say things like that. The universe is moving towards freedom. And a part of this story is that humans are distinct from all the other animals insofar as we are the most highly evolved, we're the most intelligent, therefore we're the best and the highest manifestations. I see all kinds of problems about that, right? There's an idea that there's some kind of natural process going on by which freedom is increased in the world. There's a distinction in Uchulan between matter and energy, right? Freedom is on the side of energy. We're moving towards that. Freedom is the goal of the universe. I can just take all that stuff and chuck it. It all comes from Hegel. It all sounds like a part of a civilization narrative and a colonial narrative which has been imposed on the rest of the world and which has justified European expansion, and probably some form of those similar narratives about progress and evolution have justified other colonizations by other nations in other times, like China. There is an interesting idea here, I suppose, which is that freedom somehow is related to differentiation. It is related to plurality. It's related to complexity. And also that it's related to mutual recognition, but recognition across difference. Now, this stuff is things that I'm all right with. Now, let me just finish up with the practical, what he says practically about freedom, I think is totally in line with this course and something that I offer for your consideration. And that is that practical freedom is the same thing as politics, as social politics. This is what Hannah Arendt, that's what I hear her saying in her On Revolution text too, that it's insofar as we take part in coming together with others and producing something that we could call a common reason, not that reason, that analytical reason which allowed us to separate out from the world and to identify the earth as nothing but a set of objects or resources, that analytical reason, Uchulan says, that was a problem. That produced alienation. And now the advanced forms of analytical reason, that is science, of course, serve an overall system. So hyper-rationality, as it exists today, complex rationality, mathematical thought, systems thought, advanced programming. These are, extremely logical behaviors and manifestations and apparatuses. But in our world, this reason serves unreason. It serves a system which has no root except in raw power, and in fact has a trajectory which, if we stand back and look at it, an infinite will to accumulation of surplus in a situation of finite resources. It's an irrational process. Capitalism, state building, are irrational processes. They do not serve the goals that we could rationally affirm, like I want my grandchildren to be happy in a clean world where there's lots of love. These systems that science and mathematics serve, these high forms of rationality serve, the system itself is not rational. But there is a form of rationality which does not have this problem, and that is what happens when we get together and talk honestly. And through this talking honestly, we discover commonalities that we can feel, commonalities that we can understand, commonalities which also help us to analyze a situation, but not to reify it, not to turn it into a target for exploration or a potentiality for a certain amount of energy or potentiality for a certain amount of capital. No, we look at the situation in terms of a capacity to transform ourselves and to make ourselves more free and to make ourselves more powerful. This gathering together, what was Ishbael Tamuk, and the formation of Owan and the Tzatzal understanding, this is freedom on this view. And that I dig. And then if you look at how, you know, like the Zapatista form of governance across time, or the form of, you know, structuring governance and interlacing of co-ops, communes, and councils in Rojava become more complex across time, then you can see society forming itself, a democratic society forming itself without a state, without alienating some part of itself and then alienating entirely its ability to choose and to engage in its own action. That's freedom growing. So a larger scale society, which is still broken down into units or groupings, which are themselves self-determining, that is the growth of freedom. And so on the large scale, what freedom looks like is differentiation. And this does not do away with difference. The form of nation that might exist here is not the same as the nationalism that says that everybody has to be the same. Everybody has to match this standard where you all have to be blonde-haired, blue-eyed, male, and fit, and 26 years old, or else, you know, you are in varying degrees inhuman. In Rojava, for real, they've just, you know, like in the Zapatista condition, they set up revolutionary laws. They've made their own edicts and their own experimental leaps about how to organize and how to modulate their own activities, their own practices, and their collective practices. In Rojava, they've done the same thing, and they have specifically said, okay, every committee that we make that is going to enact some decision of some assembly has to have at least 40% women. Any leadership has to involve equal representation by women or equal participation by women as it does by men. Every community, every assembly, every committee coming out of an assembly in a particular community must involve the participation of every ethnicity there, because we're talking about Kurds and the Kurdish freedom movement or nationalist, you know, independence movement here. But in that territory, especially because of the Syrian war, which in a lot of ways makes the economic footing for that society possible, because they are able to take over previously state-run lands and industry once Assad was put back on his heels. That war has pushed a whole bunch of different people up into that territory. So there's lots of Armenians, and there's lots of Arabs, and there's lots of Syriacs, and there's lots of Turkmen, and as well as the Kurdish and various other peoples, right? So this is a pluralistic system. They intentionally include people speaking different languages, pursuing different religious paths. They are all involved in these instances of freedom, if you like. They're all involved in these assemblies where their voices and their concerns and their decision-making power weigh equally with everybody else. They're involved in talking through to as close as they can get as to a consensus in order to make any decisions which impact them. Okay, so this is a free society. And it's not just like a made-up thing. It's not just his vision. It's like something that is actually being practiced, messed with experimentally. It's imperfect in various ways. Like, you know, they have real big problems because they fought ISIS. They fought ISIS and won, both, you know, male and female militia detachments equally fought and defeated ISIS. But then they have ISIS fighters in prisons, right? And then the United States pulled its special forces out, which is how the Kurds ended up surrounded by the Russians and the Turks and the Syrians. And then they're, you know, a bunch of these, they're imprisoning a whole bunch of people, and some of those people are escaping, right? Like, neither imprisoning people nor having you know, radical ISIS members escaping and reorganizing themselves is desirable. Right. So the world is imperfect. The world is hybrid. And yet they are still attempting to manifest in the situation that is given to them something like human freedom. So how do we move in this direction? Well, freedom and democracy are inseparable on this view. And we free society by politicizing it. We have to make ourselves, convince others, facilitate others, being able to gather themselves together into groups, think about their own interests, and make decisions and act on those things. You know, as the Invisible Committee says, never forget the political dimension of friendship. We need to politicize everything. Let me add, I guess, one last thing to that. which is coming from that Panzer text about Uchelon. What is it that we need to move towards? His understanding of Uchelon is that Uchelon is moving towards what he calls a genuine socialist governmentality. This would, again, be some manifestation of the kind of social situation we've talked about in many instances before. Recognition-based groupings across plurality, a situation of real participation at the economic, political, and cultural levels, engaging in participation, a development of the power of everybody there, the power to perceive, the power to understand, the power to act. We want to be developing potentialities. These are signs of a free society. And the key point that Panzer draws out that I think is really good is that what Uchelon is recommending, what the Kurds, at least the Kurds in this portion of Kurdistan and Rojava recommend, what I think the Zapatistas recommend, what I think the dual power model that is given in Cooperation Jackson. So we want to resurge as society. We want to rebuild society, a network of relations, and create our own frame. We want a situation where society creates its own frame outside of the state. Outside of the state. We want politics, real politics for real people exists in real gatherings determined by those people. It does not have anything to do with incorporation into the state. Insofar as we strengthen ourselves as a real society, rebuild ourselves as a real society based on friendship and ethics and mutual trust and mutual recognition and determinations, local determinations, insofar as we do that, we are building the counterbalance to this system, which is killing everything.